premiums to rise, deductibles to rise, co-payments for care to rise. But all of that started way before the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act did not cause that. It may have perpetuated it and made it happen a little bit faster. But this new bill does not do any change to how health care is delivered. All it does is it provides a way to cut benefits, to provide less coverage to people, so that people end up buying an insurance policy that essentially offers them no coverage. There's a lot of benefits that the Affordable Care Act did do, like allowing children to stay on their parents' policy till they're 26. It required some benefits that needed to be included, such as maternity care, physical therapy, long-term care, a whole variety of things that they've now taken out so that insurance companies don't have to provide this. So what it does is it says it's an insurance policy, but it's really not insuring people, because what they've done is, to make it affordable, they've deleted the benefits. And then Medicaid, which is a big provider of health care, they've just decimated, and the number of people who are now going to be uninsured is going to be phenomenal.
Certainly, the Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare has focused a lot of national attention on the question of whether or not health care is a human right. And the Republicans certainly, by and large, have come down in opposition to the notion that people have a right to get health care when they're sick. How has this debate, in your view, moved opinion, if at all, in the direction of people around the country now believing that healthcare is a human right, as it is in most of the other industrialized nations of the world who have a universal healthcare system of some kind in place?
Yes. Well, PNHP, the Physicians for National Health Program, clearly believe that healthcare is a right. And like you say, more and more people are believing that too. But a lot of the country does not, especially the Republicans who are sponsoring this bill. And one of the things that they promote is this argument that the market forces will finally stabilize healthcare costs and will solve this whole healthcare problem, and that competition in buying health insurance policies will, the competition itself will help lower costs. But it doesn't do that, because that does nothing to what the market allows things to be, what the market allows things to cost. If we look at what we pay in this country, for example, for a chest x-ray, we pay maybe 10 times as much as other industrialized countries with a single-payer system. Same thing for everything. A cardiac bypass can cost 3 to 4 times as much here in this country. And it's not any better here than it is elsewhere.
Dr. Rogers, how has all this controversy about Obamacare and now this Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare, how has it contributed or not to strengthening support for a single-payer universal health care system of some kind here in this country?
Yes, I think over the years, the numbers of people who support single-payer has increased. And if you look nationally, it is now the majority of physicians nationally support a single-payer system. And I think there's just a lot of confusion about what single-payer is, which really kind of tempers the support that we should be able to garner. And now the numbers, like I said, the numbers of doctors and non-physicians who are supporting single-payer has increased.
That was Dr. Susan Rogers, a retired Chicago internist and advisor to the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Find more information on the campaign for single-payer universal health care by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, GDPR in Nashville, Tennessee, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Welcome to WPKN's Mic Check. I'm Al Robinson, coming to you on PKN every Sunday at 5:30. Our diverse roster of hosts present a wide range of topics for discussion, focusing on global, national, and regional issues and their effect on local community. Just as the phrase mic check was used to mobilize people to create a human microphone during the Occupy movement, this weekly program amplifies our community's many voices and brings them to the airwaves. And I'd like to welcome with me Valerie Richardson, who's joining me in studio live.
Yeah, hey, how are you?
Good, how are you, Valerie?
It's
nice to see you. So this is kind of my debut voyage here by myself. I was on one other time with Valerie, but she was in the captain's seat, and we've switched our roles. So I guess welcome to the show.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, today's topic is we're going to be talking about the gubernatorial race, the governor's race for 2018. We'll go back a little ways here. While his stunning announcement, Governor Malloy announced back in April that he was not going to be seeking re-election, it paved the way for the next generation of politicians in both political parties to kind of shoot for the state's highest office. And a large field has already been raising money even before Malloy's decision, some of them announcing exploratory committees before the governor had announced he was not running. And those who have started raising money, including even here in Bridgeport, Mayor Gannon, have made other moves towards starting to gather their support for this office. Immediate speculation on the Democratic side went to Lieutenant Governor Nancy Wyman, who stood next to Malloy after he made his announcement. And before he even finished his announcement, people were asking her, are you considering running? And she has not, at this point, made any decision. And so we kind of are waiting. And at the same time, there's a number of candidates lining up. When asked if the governor would endorse Wyman, Malloy responded, I love Nancy Wyman, and she's got decisions to make. So it doesn't look like she has made any decisions. Wyman, who turned 71 in April, was not giving interviews on her future and has declined immediate comment. So it's kind of wide open for 2018, it appears.
And I'll just interject that I had suggested we talk about this, even though it is more than a year away today, because I know that you had an extensive conversation during the past week with one of the candidates.
One of the candidates from Middletown, Connecticut, the mayor of Middletown, Connecticut, Dan Drew, who actually announced his exploratory committee back in January. This was 4 months prior to when the governor announced his intention not to run. So, you know, one of the first questions I had for the mayor was, well, did you know this news was coming before it came? And he goes, no, I had no idea. And so the next question, of course, was, well, then how are you throwing your name into the ring? And he said basically that, you know, he was very serious about the job of governor and that, you know, he needed to start as soon as possible to get the funds that were needed. You know, he's going to be campaigning on part of the public finance system, which is where he takes $100 donations maximum from anybody. This is truly a public campaign that he's not going to be seeking money from hedge fund operators or lobby groups or anything like this. So this is a very grassroots campaign. And in order to raise that kind of money, $100 at a time, you have to start early. So he kind of got out in front of it before it was even announced. And, you know, I guess he's just speculating or, you know, he's looking for opportunity. But it seemed like a good move on his part. Recently, July 12th, he announced that he was going from an exploratory committee into he's actually become a confirmed candidate for governor of Connecticut. And he's one of many.
But is he the first one who's officially declared his candidacy?
I believe so. I believe so. I don't believe there's any others that have formally declared. And again, he stated the reason was that, you know, he wanted to, you know, raise the money that was needed. He was going to do this campaign through the public finance system. As you might be aware or not aware, the campaign finance system in Connecticut is a little bit complex, but there are rules that govern, you know, if you do a campaign with a public finance system, you know, you're getting basically money from, you know, Connecticut to run your campaign. And in doing so, you promise not to take donations over $100, which I think this makes him kind of an interesting candidate because, you know, again, he's not going to be owned or bought by the hedge fund operators, that this is truly going to be a campaign for the people. During his announcement speech, he talked a great deal about the shrinking middle class in Connecticut and how this was something that he was very interested in. As mayor in Middletown, he talked a lot about things that he did in the city to try to help the shrinking middle class. He was recently in the news for a campaign. There was going to be cuts in the Middletown Transit Authority. These were buses that people relied on to get to cities like Meriden and Hartford and to go to work. And they were going to cut back a number of their routes. And although the city government in Middletown has really nothing directly to do with the Middletown Transit Authority, you know, as mayor, he was out in front of that with other leaders trying to keep these routes open and to keep the bus routes for people that needed them, working people, working middle-class people. So he seems that he's very interested in not just how government works under his leadership, but how it also works around him under his leadership. You know, that I think it would have been easy for him just to walk away from the Middletown Transit problem and say, well, you know, it's not part of our government, fold his hands and walk away. But he said, you know, this is going to affect a lot of people in Middletown, people who work and live here. I have to get into this situation and I have to, you know, work on it. So that was probably a very successful thing. He's had a number of things happen in the city that, you know, Middletown is a really wonderful city. I don't know if you've ever been there. It is a city. It's urban.
It's a lovely city.
And as you walk in there, you can't help but feel the quality of life in the city. I mean, for a city, it brings a great deal of quality of life. You go down its main street. It's very inviting. It's very safe. Some of the stuff the mayor talked about in his speech was he talked about how Middletown, under his leadership, has had an 18% reduction in crime. Pretty significant. And, you know, he's done this not through any drastic change in the size of the police force. He hasn't doubled the size of the police force or anything like that. But he's asked that there be campaigns where the police get involved with the neighborhood people and that they build these relationships with people of the community. And so, you know, this basically has turned about, obviously, attitudes and stuff in the city of Middletown, and they are enjoying a real nice, safe, clean city right now.
You are listening to listener-supported WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM online at wpkn.org. This is the weekly show called Mic Check, which comes here on the every Sunday between 5:30 p.m. and 6 p.m. And Al Robinson is hosting today. I'm Valerie Richardson. I'm also sitting in. And Alice, we were talking about this as we're looking forward in just over a year to the next gubernatorial election. We're also doing this at the back, talking about this against the backdrop of the current situation.
Yeah.
And Dana Malloy has been in office now for a few years. Inherited and has just had a very, very difficult time with the state budget. This year's budget is not yet in place, and 21 days past when it would normally have gone into effect. And over the last three or four years, there have been has been a drastic austerity budget that has cut programs in every direction, social programs and education and to funding to cities, funding to arts. Just everything has been cut, and a lot of this was because, as Governor Malloy would explain it, he had inherited a pension program from with the unions that has not really been dealt with over the last number of administrations, and he is now dealing with it. So, whoever comes into this position, did Dan Drew discuss this when
he did in his speech? He did address it in the sense that Connecticut needs to look at its funding stream and how it collects money and how it goes about collecting taxes. And he talked about kind of a regressive tax structure that's in place as opposed to, I guess, a progressive. And, you know, my impression from listening to him speak, he's definitely a progressive. And, you know, a progressive tax structure, well, I guess the way I understand it, and I've read about this a little bit on some of the blogs that I read. I read the Jonathan Pelto blog. Jonathan was a House representative for like a number of years here in Connecticut, and he has a wonderful blog. He talks about the his talk about the regressive tax structure in Connecticut is the upper class, like the 1%, the very, very, very wealthy in this state, pay about a 5% tax in income tax per year. The middle class, which is where most of us are, pay about 10%, and the lower class, the very disadvantaged in the state, pay about 12%. So it's the most wealthy paying 5.5%, and the least advantaged, the most disadvantaged citizens in Connecticut paying 12%. So it is a regressive tax. It is kind of something in reverse. And he talked about changing that funding stream in the other direction so that the most advantaged, that 1%, are paying more of their share. They generate, you know, a great deal of the income. And he says that they've been kind of coddled. And so he's looking for them to step up and pay their share. And that was part of his campaign announcement, you know, that he's really interested in the shrinking middle class and kind of protecting that and trying to help that grow. He feels he has a number of initiatives. One of the things he talked about was single-payer healthcare in Connecticut. That was something that was talked about, obviously, in the presidential campaign, I think by Bernie Sanders and by Hillary, single-payer. But it was, you know, it didn't come to be. Our election, we didn't elect those people. So now we're looking at something different. And in fact, there may be a number of people in this country that don't have insurance. Well, under a single payer tax system in Connecticut, that would protect all. It would be extended Medicare. All would have insurance. He believes that that's going to help a number of entrepreneurships in Connecticut, small business. Number of small businesses, you know, have struggled with trying to provide their employees with health benefits that, you know, they can't keep a small business going because, you know, our health benefits are almost equal to a small salary. Now, I know where I work, my health benefits, I have a family plan, it's close to $22,000 for that plan. And that's a small salary. So he's talking about single payer would eliminate that burden on entrepreneurships and small business owners, mom and pop shops, so to speak. He is trying to just basically make more opportunity for more small businesses. And that's, in fact, something that he has done in Middletown. There are over several hundred small businesses that have opened and have grown and thrived in Middletown, you know. And so I guess unemployment is down in Middletown as well as entrepreneurship and small business is up. And so that seemed like the overall, you know, one of the overall things he talked about single-payer health care. He talked about a number of things. He talked about in Middletown, he was able to bring the Federal Express Distribution Center to Middletown. It's a 265-acre distribution center that was brought in. It was, you know, attractive for Federal Express to set up this distribution center in Middletown, and a lot of that, again, was done through the work of the mayor in Middletown. I think he really has an idea of how to bring this about. You know, he's only been a local mayor, and he was mayor, I think he served two-year terms. He was actually, the first time he ran for mayor, he actually lost by 200 votes, and he came back for another election, and he won that election. And then he served a second two-year term. This is actually the beginning of his four-year term. They actually changed the rules, the town charter. I couldn't think of the right word. They changed the town charter to allow for a four-year term on the mayor. So obviously, I think they're very in love with their mayor and what he's done for them as well. So a lot of excitement there. Obviously, I think there was a lot of Middletown people that were there. I saw many of the men in fire uniforms and police uniforms. I'm assuming they were probably leaders of the police and fire union there to support his candidacy. There were, you know, a number of things. And one of the things he talked about, how he changed government in Middletown, how he actually saved money without losing jobs and without cutting services. He ended years of costly lawsuits between the city and the Board of Education, leading a bipartisan coalition of board and council members to the most positive working relationship that's ever existed in the city. Together, they created a financial partnership that existed. Together, they reformed Middletown's police. They appointed a new police chief and deputy chief, and all ushered in a whole different culture, as we talked about, in policing. As mayor, he led a bipartisan coalition group to enact various senior tax relief programs, bought prescription drug discount programs to seniors, negotiated contracts that saved taxpayers millions. I think he used one of the examples he talked about was how Middletown just had an enormous amount of litigation going on in the city, and they were farming all this out to private law firms. And so there were some law firms that were doing pretty well with this. They were making some pretty good money just representing the city. And what he did was he bought on board a small force of lawyers, and instead of farming it out, he did it in-house, and he was able to save the city millions of dollars. So he's looking at government in a different kind of way. And although he has experience at the executive branch, you know, he's kind of a Hartford outsider, and I think, you know, he brings a breath of fresh air, his ideas to Hartford. How can we look at things a little different? How can we do something? It's not business as usual. Certainly, I think all of us would agree, we can't have a status quo look at the way we're doing things, you know, especially with the way things are in right now with the budget. You know, in the state of Connecticut right now, we're under executive, I guess, for lack of a better word, executive order. We don't have a budget from the House and the Senate. It's the governor's budget. And that budget is based on last year's dollar amount. It doesn't go above last year's dollar amount, although inflation has pushed that budget beyond that. You know, there's pension increases, there's health insurance increases. So as those costs go up, our services have gone down since July 1st because, you know, simply the governor doesn't have the same money power that he would have if he kept up with inflation. So there have been a number of cuts to social services that are going on. People are feeling that as this budget drags on. It doesn't seem to be much in the way of something coming down the pike. I mean, you know, the different sides are talking, but it doesn't seem like they're talking to each other. They're talking amongst themselves. And we kind of have been in a stalemate. I've talked to some representatives, and they've told me that, you know, some are more optimistic and say, well, you know, maybe we'll see something in the middle or in the July. And then others are like, well, this could go until October, you know. Mm. So we really don't know where we're going. It's kind of uncharted waters for us. And but it's very disconcerting because I think there's people out there who have lost services and, you know, they are suffering as a result. So we have to look at government in a different way.
And, it, you know, it is interesting that Dan Drew has come out there and as one of the first persons who is articulating the issues as progressive. So that's mm-hmm. that's very interesting. And also I was wondering, just how, certainly, as someone who moved here from a state that has county governments, this is a very different sort of beast, where you have 169 municipal governments, and in particularly in the cities, with a lot of the funding coming from property taxes, there just has been such a divide between the poor cities and the wealthy suburbs, and certainly there's a big court case right now to address the educational inequalities within the state, and so that's also this very much against the background of what's going on, the climate of our state and the climate of the money, the climate of the inequalities. So that's what did he talk about with just sort of that, is there another way? And you talked about progressive revenue, but is there another way within cities? Is there, to rethink the way that whole state does this?
Well, one of the things we did talk about was how education policies are done in the state. And one might imagine that, the Democrats have always been the undisputed champions of public education, but current resistance to the Trump-DeVos education movement is really, there's an inconvenient truth that the Democrats have kind of been promoting in the last, so many years, this conservative school reform agenda, and that's one of the things that, I guess Democrats, in trying to be in this centrist position and trying to lure Republicans to vote for Democrats, they've taken on this centrist position, this education reform position. And, Dan Drew talked about that. He talked about how he didn't see the need to try to appeal to these people who would probably never agree with him, that he feels that Democrats should be true to their roots and that they should be they should act like progressives and not like Republicans. So, and that's something that we've seen here for a while in the state of Connecticut.
And full disclosure, you are a teacher yourself.
That's right. So whenever, the Democratic Party has kind of lost its way on public education, in a very real sense, the Democrats paved the way. Some might argue that they've paved the way for DeVos and Trump to do this reform in public education. And so, 30 years ago, there was a sharp difference. But, in the last 6 years under this governor, it was kind of a difference that's a little less negotiable. I've heard some people actually refer to our current governor as the so-called Democratic governor. They don't feel that he's acted like a true Democrat, that he's kind of been dragged over a little bit to the other side. So that was some of the stuff that he talked about. When Barack Obama took office, educators hoped that the party would return kind of back to its public school roots. This was after we had gone through No Child Left Behind with George Bush. But the Obama years saw even an epidemic of new charter schools in this country. We saw that in Connecticut. And that's even one of the most interesting things to me right now, is that even under this austerity budget that we're talking about, there recently was an approval for 500 more seats in the charter schools here in Connecticut. Now, how do we find that money under an austerity budget? I'm not quite sure. But, it seems to be that, we've been on this wrong side of reform. And so he was talking about, going back to the original direction that the party was in. And so the entire idea of choice, you have to remember, the whole idea of choice was kind of, it's an old idea from Republicans, and it was kind of from the 60s. The idea of choice was the idea of segregation in the South. And that's where this whole reform movement kind of has its roots. And that's, always an alarming thing. So, I'm looking up at the clock. We're running to just about out of time. So this is a subject, education. I could talk a whole half hour on this, obviously, and a number of things. But anyway, Dan Drew, progressive candidate, and he's out there now, and he's working under the public finance system. From what I understand, that is something not every candidate is eligible for the public finance system. If you have a record, if you have a if you're a convicted felon or something like that, you're not eligible for the public finance system. And of course, that does create a problem if you're trying to run a grassroots campaign and you can't utilize the public finance system. Then you really are beholden to the only way to get elected and to raise money for your office is the hedge fund operators. The good news is Dan Drew is pure. He's not He's not a felon, and so he's not touched by that stigma, and he's able to use the public finance system. I think this makes him, you know, an important candidate to look at because, you know, he's not influenced by the hedge fund operators or the